Welcome in this episode of Swiss Ocean Services. I am very pleased today to welcome Raffaella von Weichs. Hi, Raffaella.
Hi, Gilles.
May I introduce you as a social and cultural anthropologist working at the Institute of Social Sciences of Religions at the Lausanne University?
Absolutely correct.
So, Raffaella, in 2023 and 4, you've conducted a provenience research on music instruments at the Geneva Museum of Ethnography, abbreviated MEG. Can you tell us more about this project in particular, its objectives, and the approach you chose for it?
My task was to do provenience research in the framework of the coming exhibition, Afrosonica, Paysage Sonore, or Soundscapes. And in this exhibition, the objective was to get to know the history of the instruments to be exhibited. That's a very important criteria for the preparation of the exhibition, to know where the objects come from and what is their biography, in fact. How did they come to the museum and what happened to them and how were they collected or taken by force? So I had to find their, first of all, the provenance and then, in addition, the story of their provenience.
I very much like the idea of objects that tell a story. This, of course, very much opened up a space in this series, which is also about listening and about the Swiss context. Now we can start with a few examples from your research. The first is the lamellophone instrument from Namibia that was collected by François Coillard, who was a French missionary born in 1834. So perhaps you want to tell us a bit more about the object, but also about Coillard.
François Coillard was a missionary of the Paris Evangelical Missionary Society, and he had the task to establish more missionary stations in southern Africa. Among the different missionary societies, there was sort of a competition for influence, and each missionary society was linked to certain colonial powers. And like this, Coillard had a certain affiliation with the British colonial power in southern Africa. And he explored the region of present-day Zambia and Zimbabwe. He met a group of Namibia people and got hold of this mbira.
I propose to listen to a short audio recording to get a sense a little bit of how this thumb piano may sound.
The collection of cultural objects or cultural artifacts representative of African cultures were from the start a critical element in this missionary enterprise. Why? Because objects, especially ritual objects, and most of musical instruments have a ritual function in Africa. They pose sort of a threat to the idea of religion, of Christianity imported to these cultures. So in order to establish these new religions in Africa, these missionaries, had to extract those ritual objects which were part of the cultures they wanted to evangelize and to hand them over to the museum. And this museum was created in Geneva, and later on it was donated to the city of Geneva, and it was integrated into the museum's landscape of Geneva. So finally, most of those objects arrived in the MEG, which was specialized on ethnographic objects. But you can see that there was an explicit policy, an explicit strategy behind this collection of ethnographic objects, including instruments.
Moving on to a second example, we have the case of an object collected by Fernand Grébert. It's a lamellophone as well, but this time from Gabon, and it was collected between 1913 and 1931. That's the moment where Fernand Grébert was in Africa. He was himself born in 1886, and he was also working for the Paris Evangelical Missionary Society.
What we need to see is Grébert came to Gabon later, in the first part of the 20th century. And that makes already a little bit difference compared to the time of Koya. Because, as for example, Bénédicte Savoy writes in her book, To Whom Belongs the Beauty, from 1885 onwards, the conference in Berlin, things changed a lot. From that time on, we can observe that the collection of ethnographic objects increased incredibly. And Fernand Grébert was one of those people who contributed to this increase of collections. At that time, there was already a quite big market of ethnographica for the art market. And so interest in those objects was also increasing, and also the prices for such objects were becoming more interesting. Later on, when this missionary had to stop his work in Gabon, he also offered ethnographic objects to sell to the museums in Geneva and Neuchâtel. He approached the local cultures very systematically, and this we can see from his drawings, because he was a very skillful drawer. And he later on published an album of his drawings, very beautiful, which is in the museum's library in Geneva, where we can see which objects he discovered while working in the villages and in the mission station, and also sometimes which objects he extracted, so to say, he collected, because the same objects are now in the storage of the museum. So it's interesting to see not only the object, but also the drawing.
Yes, and if I may add, there might be even one more additional link, since, again from your notes, in 1928, Fernand Grébert published a book called Musical Art Among the Thang of Gabon, in which he classified musical instruments according to an evolutionist and racialized framework, inspired by the writing of physician Georges Montandon. For me, also as a musician, it's super interesting to see that a fundamentally racist theory can be applied to musical instruments.
Yeah, I'm not an ethnomusicologist, but in fact, this classification of Montandon was used to bring an order in all this assembly of instruments, and also to hierarchize them in the logic of evolutionism. Mm-hmm. And I think in this respect, Grébert was just a child of his time and did not have a critical approach to such theories and to evolutionism and so on. But he was rather supportive of such theories. And also Pitard, Eugène Pitard, the director of the MEG, was one of the driving forces of such theories. And so it's no wonder that Grébert, who cooperated with him, that they shared the same approach in a way.
Well, exactly. And I think this very well brings us to another example from your research, and this time from the perspective of instruments collected by scientists. So this next example is a Bata kettle drum from Niger. It was purchased by Marguerite Lopsiger Dellenbach in 1948. She was deputy director of the Museum of Ethnography in Geneva. And on that year, she embarked on an ethnographic mission to Niger, where she joined her colleague Jean Gabu, the then director of the Museum of Ethnography of Neuchâtel.
When we go to scientists or anthropologists like Marguerite Lopsiger Dellenbach, she wanted to complete the museum's collection. For her, the museum's collection, as a panorama of those societies, were missing objects. And so in the overall current of collecting as many objects as possible, she went on ethnographic missions with her colleague, as you said, from the Museum of Neuchâtel, and collected, in fact, as many objects as possible.
Marguerite Lopsinger Dellenbach also sought to gather anthropometric data for the laboratory headed by Eugène Pitard.
Yes, it's true. She had the mission to collect anthropometric data. So she measured a sample of people, which she prepared in advance. She knew exactly what she had to do. In every morning, she went to the dispensary and took her measures, and she had an assistant for that. This was more or less her duty. So in the afternoon, when she went on the market with her colleague, that was pleasure. That was, now I'm going to buy more, to find more exotic objects with which I can complete my collection at home. So it was enhancing her reputation, and it was enhancing Swiss reputation of participating in this production of knowledge of other societies.
We have to stay a little bit longer in this dark area of anthropometric data collection in connection to an additional example, Boris Adé, who was a Swiss doctor based, I think, between 1951 and 52 in Wamba in the Belgian Congo. So he worked as a doctor in the dispensary and was also collecting human remains for his own purposes. He would embalm the body of a deceased Mbuti woman and send it to Belgium for further scientific investigations. Before we discuss that a bit more, we could now listen to a short audio excerpt, which is, I think, an excerpt from a radio show. It's not Boris Adé himself who is speaking, but I think it's a former missionary colleague and also a Swiss-German doctor.
La science et les hommes. Le professeur Marc Sauter, directeur de l'Institut d'anthropologie de l'Université de Genève, et la presse ont signalé la récente découverte scientifique faite au Congo belge par l'un de nos compatriotes. Peut-on réellement considérer un corps humain comme une découverte? Non, sans doute, lorsqu'il s'agit d'un homme d'une race connue. Oui, quand ce corps humain recèle autant d'inconnus scientifiques que celui d'un pygmée. Le chanoine Jules Detry, qui connaît admirablement les pygmées avec lesquels il a vécu et qui suit attentivement les recherches du docteur Boris Adé, rappelle les faits.
En pleine nuit, le docteur Boris Adé est mandé au camp Putnam pour tenter de sauver une femme pygmée qui souffre d'une violente hémorragie. Au petit jour, la femme rend le dernier soupir. Une perforation ascaridienne l'a tuée. Adé songe aux autres pygmées, aux 100 000 pygmées, encore au stade premier de la cueillette et de la chasse, qui, autant que les noirs, méritent d'être soignés et compris. sa décision est prise. Il embaumera le corps de la femme pygmée. Les pygmées, vous le savez, cachent leur mort. Et seul un homme ayant toute leur confiance a pu obtenir de ces animistes qu'ils se défassent de dépouilles d'êtres chers et vénérés pour que le Muganga, le médecin, voie pourquoi ils sont de petite taille. Je viens de citer leurs paroles.
Que pensent les savants ? Voici tout d'abord l'avis du professeur Rüthishauser, qui dirige l'Institut de pathologie de Genève.
Je dois dire qu'il y a deux points, au moins, qui sont importants. D'abord, le point de vue de la science, qui ne fait que profiter de tout ce qui est investigation d'une race humaine qui tente à disparaître et qui est déjà, les premiers résultats le montrent, prodigieusement intéressant. Ça, c'est le côté de la science dite pure. Il y a un autre côté qui est tout aussi important, c'est le côté de la médecine appliquée. Et il sera certainement important aussi pour les pygmées d'avoir été examinés, je dirais à fond, pour qu'on sache leur anatomie particulière et leur maladie particulière, qu'on pourra mieux dépister sur des bases plus objectives.
Jules Détry takes side with Boris Adé and his project of physical anthropology and evolutionism and exploration of the body of African people who have died under his responsibility as a doctor. And then he switches roles and becomes a scientist and goes as far as exporting those now turned into material corpses. I think that's the main scandal in this story. And of course, in recent years in Switzerland, colonial history has become a very important issue, but there's still a lot to do, and a lot of this history is unknown. And that's why I think prominence research is so important and so interesting, not only in relation to musical instruments and soundscapes, which of course is one approach, but in relation to many, many other objects, not least human remains, which are still in the storage, not only in the MEG, but also in other museums, and also in the university, like the Anthropological Institute of Geneva. So that's part of the real scandal and the question what to do.
Okay, so listening back to this recording, for me personally, I find it very disturbing. And perhaps that's no surprise, but the more interesting is perhaps why I find it disturbing. Of course, it's the choice of word in those interviews that is in itself already shocking, but also the tone. So when the missionary speak of Mbuti people in terms of animist, he doesn't just share the information that they are animist. He literally, in his tone, underlines how crazy and retarded that is to be an animist. So I think that's simply hurtful to hear. And this also with this Swiss-German doctor who aligns with this kind of racist and evolutionist theories. But there, what touches me is his Swiss-German accent when speaking French. And for me, this Swiss-German accent is so Swiss that it's a sign of direct involvement of Switzerland with those histories. And that's why I really wanted to share that recording, because to Swiss ears, this is not so obvious. I had never heard anything like this on the radio or in any history class. That's why I have a particular affect towards this recording.
The point here is not to justify what they did. On the contrary, the point is to unravel their motivations and their logics and the networks in which they were operating and for which reason. Because all too often, I think, we have a very narrow view, but what we need to do is to broaden our view and to see how, for example, Switzerland was part of a bigger picture, was part of evolutionary theories, of the construction of racist theories. And although it was a small country and although it had officially no colonies, as many scientists have now shown, it played a role in this.
I think one important question also that we have to address is to what extent in your project or in this kind of provenience research projects, the perspective of local people can find a place.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have the chance to travel to some of these countries, or how to counterbalance then this lack of possibility for people to be part of the conversation?
Yeah, that's one of the core questions, I think, now in the provenience research. How can provenience research be made fruitful? How far should it go? What should be the focus of it? Is it enough, for example, to invite people of source communities to Switzerland, to Geneva, to revive these instruments? Or collaborations with artists from Africa to create artistic projects in the museum with objects or with sound from the sound archive? Is it enough? Or must it go further? Who and how should people get access to these collections, sound and material collections? And what should they be allowed to do with it? Those are the questions that are very crucial. And of course, the more and more demands for restitution are made by source communities, the more pressing these questions are.
What is the role of listening in those processes? You made a research on music instrument. We know very well that listening is always a part of research, and how you understand this role of listening.
That's a very interesting question. I think the role of listening is not only sonic. It's not only a sonic aspect. It's also listening as an interior process. Because music, for example, or any sound is linked to emotions. Whenever we listen, for example, to sound, we have certain emotions, we have certain imaginaries. But also when we listen to text, which is not a sound. Let's take, for example, a travel journal. You can, in your imaginary, listen to the voice of the person writing it. It is completely different than an abstract scientific text. You can perform this text, give voice to it. This was one of our ideas for the exhibition also. Give, again, voice to people who have died, but who had a crucial role maybe in colonialism or in collecting artifacts or in collecting musical instruments and so on and so on. And as you just said, listening to a broadcast from this time has a certain effect on you, for example, as a Swiss. It touches you because of the accent of one of the speakers. So all this is part of listening. We do not only listen to recorded voices, but we're also listening to interior voices, even if it's our own voice. And I think this needs to be taken into account when you think about certain kind of sonicness.
Yeah, totally agree. And what about the consequences for the Swiss politics of commemoration, of acknowledgement? Because it's fundamentally about a willingness to engage with the past and acknowledge responsibility and perhaps consider not only apology, but also reparation.
Yeah. Listening to these voices, the voices from the archives, also reveals information on the part Swiss citizens and Swiss representatives of the Swiss state and of the Swiss institutions have played in the colonial, post-colonial, and in the present history. So, it's a kind of responsibility to reflect on the question, who are we? Do we have the right to construct boundaries when we have excluded people? And what was the price of this exclusion? And how did we profit from that exclusion? Or how do we still profit from it? For example, through privileges. I mean, this is not only concerning Swiss people, it's for any nation state, at least in Europe, I would say. But each nation state has its particularities, of course. For Switzerland, it's this myth of never having had colonies. But now it's becoming quite clear, the more we do research on this, that Switzerland was so much implicated in the colonial enterprise that it's difficult to hold the position that there were no colonies in which Switzerland played a part. And in fact, which were the basis of the construction of this nation state, as so many other nation states like Belgium, like Germany, like France, etc. And if we are honest and go up to the extreme, that would mean, yeah, we need to share. We need to share the passport. We need to open the borders. We need to give out visas so that there must be much more flux, much more travel of people, objects, ideas, everything, just like Arjun Appadurai proposed. So if we go in this direction, the world might be more fair.